So Joel, when you meet people at a social event or a party and they ask you, what do you do? What is it you say?
You know, that's a really, I find myself often troubled by that situation because, on the one hand, I'm a philosopher because I have an appointment as professor of philosophy here at Notre Dame and in Oxford and so on. That's what I was. But of course, before that, I was for many years a mathematician. And so am I a mathematician or a philosopher? And I don't like to have to decide between those two things. And furthermore, I'm not sure that there is a rough boundary. So usually I just say that I'm a philosopher and a mathematician.
As opposed to that kind of distinction, or it maybe distinction between philosophy and maths, I guess what people are probably more interested in is that it's about infinity. Have you found that many kind of non-academic people are just kind of really captivated by this idea and want to ask you questions about it?
Well, sure, of course. I mean, people have been thinking about infinity for thousands of years, haven't they? I mean, and it's one of those topics that, of course, you know, in ancient days, this was maybe one of the quintessential philosophical questions to ask. What is the nature of infinity and how are we to understand infinity and the distinction between potential infinity and actual infinity? Can you ever achieve an actual infinity and so on? But then it's also one of these situations where the topic, you know, at a certain point became much more mathematical and we made progress on it. It's one of these philosophical questions that we made progress on. I mean, many philosophical questions are just as hard and as unsolved today as they ever were. But I would say the case of infinity isn't really like that completely because it was many centuries leading up, and then with the developments of Cantor in the late 19th century and the realization that we could have mathematical proof that there were different sizes of infinity, it was sort of, it feels like progress. And then, of course, now we have a deep understanding of the mathematical conceptions of infinity with the large cardinal axioms and so forth. And so it's one of these cases where we're making progress on what is at bottom a deeply philosophical idea.
So as you say, like people have been interested in infinity and kind of captivated for a millennia. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's inherently interesting, isn't it? I mean, we can imagine, the numbers, you know, you can just start counting. Maybe you start with zero or maybe you start with one. So zero, one, two, three, and so on. And there doesn't seem to be any end to them. And it seems difficult to imagine how they would ever end. And so so there's an infinity of these numbers. And thinking about the nature of numbers, you're just sort of led automatically to the concept of infinity, it seems to me. And if you think about, say, a straight line, a geometric line, a continuum, and you could divide it in half and divide again and so on and produce more and more. And if you have, you know, only finitely many points, you can just put more points in between. And it seems you could always further subdivide whatever kind of divisions you've made. And so it's inherently part of the sort of mathematical landscape, isn't it? And maybe kind of confusing, you know, the nature of infinity. For example, Galileo had talked about some confusions about infinity, because he pointed out that, well, if you think about the perfect squares, so like, for example, well, one is a perfect square, and 4 and 9 and 16, 25, 36, and so on. These are the numbers that are perfect squares. It seems like there's more numbers than there are perfect squares, because there's all the numbers in between them, right? So, but Galileo pointed out, nevertheless, we can kind of match them up because we can match every number n with n squared. We can match 1 with 1 and 2 with 4 and 3 with 9 and 4 with 16 and so on. And so from that point of view, when you can match up to collections, you know, in a one-to-one correspondence, then you would expect that they have the same size. And so the number of perfect squares should maybe be the same as the number of numbers, even though it also seems like there should be strictly more. And that is maybe deeply confusing, this tension between the two principles that if you add elements to a collection, then it gets strictly larger, which is a basic phenomenon. I mean, it's like it's known as Euclid's principle. The whole is greater than the part. But there's another principle. It's called Hume's principle, or the Cantor-Hume principle, that says when you can match up two collections with a one-to-one correspondence, then they should have the same size. And Galileo's observation is that these two principles are in tension. His response, unfortunately, was kind of to throw up his hands and say, therefore, we cannot make comparisons between infinite collections. It's not sensible to say that one infinite collection is more or less or the same as another. And so it was quite some time before Cantor and the other mathematicians in the late 19th century really took the situation to heart with the Hume's principle, with Cantor-Hume principle, and said, no, we want to say those two collections do have the same size, and it's a feature of infinity that the whole can be the same size as a proper part.
Yeah, as you talk about some of the kind of tensions that the concept of infinity brings up between different ideas, what are some of the kind of classic tensions or paradoxes maybe that infinity gives rise to? Perhaps one of them being this idea, as you mentioned, of there's the kind of different sizes of infinity. So it's not just kind of one infinity. What are some of the kind of these kind of classic paradoxes?
Well, there's all kinds of paradoxes that arise with infinity. In fact, I teach a course now here. I designed a course last year. The title of the course is just infinity, and we just move from one paradox to the next. And so, of course, Galileo has a show in that course, but there's many others. So, I mean, one of the things that Cantor proved, which is sort of the most one of the most important observations to make about infinity and the nature of infinity, is Cantor's proof that there are different sizes of infinity. And what he proved was that the collection of real numbers cannot be placed into a one-to-one correspondence with the collection of natural numbers. So if you have the natural numbers 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on, there's no way of matching that infinity up with the infinity of the number line, which has all the real numbers, you know, a place for every real number on there. So not only the integers and the fractions and so on, but also the irrational numbers like the square root of 2 and so on, and the transcendental numbers like pi and e and so on. Then the real numbers include all of those ones, and you just can't put them on a list. They cannot be placed on a countable list. So a set that can be put into correspondence with the natural numbers is said to be countable. And what Cantor proved is that the real numbers are uncountable. You cannot count them, even on an infinite counting. And it was just kind of remarkable and mind-blowing at the same time, the idea that there are different sizes of infinity, different orders of infinity. And Cantor proved not only that the reals are uncountable, but that for any given infinite collection, there is a larger one. So what he proved is that, for example, if you have any set, even an infinite set or a finite set, doesn't matter, then the number of subsets of the set is strictly larger than the set itself. So one can say this in a kind of, oftentimes when I have my students prove it, and then I immediately go to the kind of anthropomorphic version of it. If you have a collection of people, you could imagine forming committees from these people. And what's a committee? Well, it's basically a subset of the people. So there's the universal committee, everyone's on it, and there's all the one-member committees and all the two-member committees and so on. The empty committee doesn't have any members. That's the best one. the theorem translates to the statement that for any collection of people, even if it's infinite, there's more committees than people. And you can run through the proof. Cantor's proof turns into a proof in this committee case.
I'm really glad you gave that example, because it's reminded me of something I kind of wanted to ask, and something I don't quite understand about infinity. And I've been thinking, what I've been kind of brushing up on this big topic the last couple of days. So if you had a kind of group of people, and you said that you're able to create, there's an infinite number of kind of committees that you could have divided that up into, or even let's just say counting, you could always add one, you could keep counting forever. What I don't quite understand is, given that maybe people are going to eventually die, or you will either just have, you know, one, you either just, you surely need to stop doing the activity at one point. Like, is it really true to say that we can keep, you can keep counting?
Well, I mean, I think that's a profound objection to make, and nobody has a really good answer to that, right? Because, I mean, of course, it's about idealization, and to what extent are our mathematical concepts, idealizations of more familiar things? I mean, even when you come with a straight line and you're doing some geometric construction, you know, Euclid told us how to construct the midpoint of a line segment, right? We make an arc this way with a compass and one this way, and we connect the two lines. This is the method of Apollonius. That constructs the perpendicular bisector, and we can make the midpoint that way. But of course, even a construction like that, which is totally finite, is saturated with idealization, you know, because the line that you draw isn't perfectly straight, the one that you actually drew, and it's not infinitely thin. It doesn't have zero thickness, right? Because, you know, if you drew it with chalk, or maybe you made a mark in sand on the ground or something in the old Greek way, you know, it's not a perfect line, and the circle that you made, the compass isn't perfectly rigid. It maybe wiggled a tiny bit when you were doing it, and so on. So, but of course, you might say, well, it doesn't really matter that the line wasn't perfectly straight, because it's representing the ideal line, which is perfectly straight. It's not the physical thing. When you draw it in the sand or on the slate with chalk, then the line isn't that thing. That's just a kind of, you know, it's a mental image that's helping you to imagine the perfect thing, right? That exists in some realm of abstraction, you know, Plato's realm of ideal forms. In that realm, in the Platonic realm, then we have the perfectly straight line with zero thickness and the perfectly circular circle and so forth, even though we can't ever produce those in physical reality. And so this problem about abstraction and idealization isn't especially about infinity, to my way of thinking. And so your objection really can be applied to any kind of mathematical argument, even finite ones, if they're not living up to the perfect idealization. And then you realize, well, actually, the mathematical arguments that we're producing are just really only about those abstractions, and they're not really making claims about what we can actually do in the physical world. They're about logical connections between these abstract forms that live in this Platonic realm, rather than about anything that we're doing. And so they're not really subject to the limitations of time and space and energy and so on that we will find ourselves limited by in the physical world. So this is one way of answering the objections. You have the wrong subject matter if you're asking, well, I would die before I finished. That doesn't say really anything about the nature of the natural numbers as an infinite collection. If you think that, you know, those mathematical objects, those abstract objects sort of exist outside of time, space, and so forth.
Okay. So yeah, me saying I can't ever count that before I die shows it's maybe not real in some particular framing, but in this different kind of abstract object sense, it doesn't really, it's not a good argument against it. I suppose then another thing I'd come back and ask would be then, and I suppose, again, this more broadly applies to numbers in general, anything kind of non-physical, but like, yeah, how would you explain it in this abstract sense? So if something like a number or infinity exists, not so kind of concretely like a stone or a glass does, is it just real insofar as it's this kind of helpful tool and idea? Is there anything a little bit different to that? How would you kind of, if someone's never heard about this idea that you've got kind of abstract things or kind of more concrete objects, how would you explain the kind of difference between those and anything else?
Well, that's fascinating. And one often finds in the philosophy of mathematics people struggling with the existence of abstract objects and the nature of, say, mathematical existence, which has to do with the existence of these abstract objects. What kind of existence is it? What kind of thing? What is a number really, right? This is a question that is motivating many, many researchers in the philosophy of mathematics. What is the nature of mathematical existence or of abstract existence? And And oftentimes people compare this abstract existence problem to the case of physical existence, like a block or a stone, as you said, or an apple on the desk, which seems totally clear to them, I guess. But I have a different view of this, and I've mentioned this a number of times. I think the physical existence case is actually deeply mysterious, and that we don't have actually a very good account of it. I mean, we're steeped in familiarity with it because we live in it and so on, but that doesn't actually mean that we understand what it means to exist physically. I think it's a profound mystery what it means to exist physically. And the progression of physics and the manner in which the theories become more and more and more complicated, the more we know, and the more mysterious, the more we know. I mean, of course, there's the Newtonian account where matter is sort of infinitely divisible and so on, but then we realize, no, actually there's an atomic theory of matter with these tiny little particles, but then it turns out they can be broken apart, and then quantum mechanics comes in, and relativity and so on, and the whole thing just becomes really, really confusing and mysterious the more we know about it. Whereas it seems like that's not really happening in the case of abstract existence. We can talk about the empty set, and it seems like we can give a pretty thorough account of what it means to say that the empty set exists as an abstract object, or even, a straight line and so on, or the real numbers and so on. So we can seem to give accounts of the nature of these existence of these abstract objects in a way that's more satisfactory and thorough than we can for the existence of a block or a stone, which is actually at bottom fundamentally mysterious. And so I reject the idea that somehow physical existence is easy and clear, whereas abstract existence is mysterious. I think that's exactly backwards. My view is that abstract existence is what we really understand, and physical existence is the one that we don't.
Is one difference between these two kinds of objects that one of them requires like a conscious being, or like a human or a conscious being to exist to bring it about into reality?
Right. It's the mathematical analog of the question about the tree falling in the forest when nobody's there and whether it makes a sound, right? So it's related to the question, I think, of whether mathematics is invented or discovered. So a lot of people are exercised by that question and come down on one side or the other. My way of thinking is that it's obviously a mix, because, some kind of mathematics, when you're doing mathematics, it feels like you're inventing it, because it's maybe a totally new idea and you're working out the basic understanding and so on. And this is the kind of situation where it seems like where you're inventing. But in other kind of realms of mathematics, it seems like where you're studying sort of an already well-studied structure, but a question that's open about them, maybe there's a number theoretic question or something, then it seems like a case of discovery, because the mathematical architecture is already there and you're looking into it and thinking, in a new way about the things that were already there. And so that feels like discovery to me. And so it seems quite clear that different kinds of mathematics, are going to be different on this question. Why should we expect that the answer to the question whether math is discovered or invented is the same for all kinds of mathematics? It seems like, it could also be, though, a kind of temporal thing, like someone invents a new idea, a new mathematical idea, and a lot of people study it. And so the first person invented it, but then later on, they're discovering things about it. Maybe at bottom it was invented, because who's the first person who ever, counted in the natural numbers and so on? Maybe they invented, but everyone else is discovering number theory. So maybe it doesn't really answer the question, but it's definitely the case that from a, speaking as a mathematician who's working in different areas, it definitely sometimes feels like invention and sometimes feels like discovery.
I'm thinking, is this the best question to ask you, or is this the worst question to ask you? But I suppose I just have to ask, what do you think infinity is?
What do I think infinity is? Well, I mean, we have lots of different kinds of infinity. And I think it's not so mysterious because we can define it mathematically and we can analyze it. Cantor was, one of his great achievements was the concept of the transfinite numbers, the well-ordered numbers, the ordinals. I think infinity just isn't quite as mysterious maybe as people sometimes think, in that actually we can talk about it and we can prove things about it quite clearly. We can write down axioms that govern the different kinds of infinity. I always teach my students how to count in the ordinals. So we can just count up to omega squared, for example, right here. We can start counting, you know, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. And we can imagine counting through all of the finite numbers. And what's the name of the first number that comes after all those natural numbers? It's called omega. This is the first infinite ordinal. But the thing about the ordinals is that you can always add 1. And so once you get to omega, then you have omega plus 1, then omega plus 2, omega plus 3, and so on. And so you can keep counting, you know, it's like a second chapter. You counted through the finite numbers, but then you got to omega, and then you count through omega plus 1, omega plus 2, omega plus 3, and so on. It's like counting through all the finite numbers again. And it's something fundamental about the ordinals, is that if you're standing at an ordinal and you look ahead, it looks exactly the same as it did from the very beginning. You always add 1, and then 2, and 3, and so on. So then, of course, after the omega plus n for every finite n, the first ordinal that's beyond those is omega plus omega. And that's also known as omega times 2. And then, of course, you have omega plus omega plus 1 and omega plus omega plus 2 and so on. And eventually, you get through this third chapter, yeah, this block that looks just like omega. So we have the initial finite copy of omega and then another block and another one. Omega times 3 plus n, omega times 4 plus n, and so on. And so so we're going to count through omega many blocks of size, each of them omega. And then the first ordinal beyond all of those is called omega squared, which is omega times omega, because it's omega many copies of omega. So that's sort of counting to omega squared. And Cantor realized that actually these ordinals just keep going forever. And it was important in his analysis that that he had this well-ordered sequence of numbers available for the kind of transfinite recursive processes that he was defining, such as the Cantor-Bendixson process. He needed these numbers to serve as indices for the transfinite constructions that he was undertaking in his set theoretic analysis. And they just played the role just perfectly. And then you realize it turns into this profound theory of the endless numbers falling through this sand timer forever. There's no end to them.
Yeah, because if you were to explain this concept to a 5-year-old or a 10-year-old, what would you say? Is it that it's just infinity is this kind of like endless possibility of something to keep continuing?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, and when my kids were little, I did teach them how to count to omega squared. I mean, and more than that, and I think that basically anybody can learn to count into the transfinite ordinals. And you can learn about these infinite numbers in the same way that you learn about, you know, I mean, how do kids learn about the natural numbers? Well, they learn to count to 10, and then they learn, well, it's a mistake sometimes some parents make, is that they teach their kids to count to 10, and they always stop at 10, like that's the end somehow. And I think that's the mistake that's made. And so what I recommend is that when you teach kids to count, you don't always stop at one number or other. You just sometimes go further and sometimes don't go further. And it teaches the concept that, you know, you can keep going forever, right? And it's like the stopping decision isn't because you got to the end, right? They don't ever end. But then by the same kind of reasoning, you can teach that actually there's numbers after all the finite numbers. things, and that's how you get to omega and omega plus one and so on. And so not only do they go forever, but they keep going after that, right? And that's the interesting part of the ordinals.
If you think about Andrew Weil's kind of work in Fermat's Last Theorem, like there was this kind of problem that he solved. There was a thing to achieve and it was solved, and then that's complete, and that's that. Is this at all like translatable to infinity? Is there anything specifically that's trying to be worked out here that you could point at? Or is it just this kind of never-ending, perhaps infinite series of problems and things to understand? Is there like something that could be solved, or many different puzzles within it?
Well, there's many. I mean, there are hundreds of open questions about, say, large cardinals, which are the strongest axioms of infinity that we have, about the nature and connections between them and so on. We have, and there's a huge body of research, you know, and hundreds of people working on these questions all around the world, and conferences held, you know, all about making progress on these open questions. So definitely it's not like infinity is finished. That's definitely not true. I mean, it's as open as any kind of topic in mathematics. Mathematicians are working on all different kinds of open questions all the time. And there is, for someone just starting in math, like at university or something, then sometimes you get the impression that math is finished because, you know, you take algebra and then calculus and so on, and linear algebra and so on. It seems like it's this progression of subjects, and each of those subjects was worked out hundreds of years ago in this sort of standard textbooks and so on. And so it's easy to get the impression or the misimpression that somehow the subject altogether is finished. But this is far from true, because pretty soon after those courses that I mentioned, you're getting close to the boundary of what we know. And then it's really exciting when one can understand open questions that are asked and just have no idea how to answer them. And so most grad students, you know, first encounter this boundary in the beginning of their graduate career, if they're going for a PhD. Then, and by the end of their program, the typical situation is that they have made progress on one of these questions and they are the world expert. That's the typical situation. You know, you start graduate school and you don't even see the boundary yet, and you start studying and you realize there's some open questions and people don't know the answer to this, and you figure it out, or a special case of it, and you push out slightly the domain of what's understood. And then at that moment, the student is standing in this totally new area that they are the world expert in. And it's just the other phenomenon about this situation that is interesting to think about is I sometimes have to warn my students, because the nature of advance in mathematics or logic or, you know, technical philosophy is often that initially you ask the question and you have no clue how to solve it or what it even means, and everything is very confusing. And you study more and you make progress and you realize, oh, I can do this, and I can do this little piece or this case, and you gradually learn more. And then by the end, okay, maybe you've figured it out, a little chunk of knowledge, you know. But the problem is, at that moment, it seems trivial, because it's because you've done all the work to make it seem trivial. So the students sometimes are in this state of mind where they lose confidence because what they have an achievement, but it seems trivial to them, like they haven't done anything, and they disvalue their own work. And I have to remind them and say, well, look, do you remember, you know, 2 years ago or whenever it was that you started, and you were struggling, and nobody had any idea how to do it. But now you know, and it's totally easy. You know, you figured it out. And that, the making of it to be easy was the accomplishment. But it's, you have to look at it that way, because actually it's easy now. It's easy, yeah. And so it's this kind of, I called it it's a kind of disease that sometimes strikes certain students, and then they, you know, maybe it's a problem because they it's undermining the motivation. But it shouldn't at all, because actually they made a huge achievement. They made something that seemed confusing and totally not understandable into something that now seems totally easy and you can understand it easily. And that's a real advance. That's how human understanding in science and any intellectual endeavor advances, by making previously complicated, mysterious things into something that we can understand easily. That's really valuable.
With infinity and, you know, so many different ideas and areas of mathematics and philosophy, these things are obviously clearly fascinating and very interesting to academics and non-academics. But with infinity, are there any or many kind of practical implications of advancing our understanding of this idea?
Sorry. I don't know any.
I thought that was unlikely to get many ideas, but I was curious if there was anything.
You know, right. I mean, I think of it as, okay, these questions about infinity and the nature of infinity, and people have been thinking about these questions for thousands of years and wondering, and we're making progress. Like, we understand things better now than they did. We're not confused about things that Galileo was confused about. I think we've got a pretty good understanding of exactly the things that he was talking about in his dialogues. And so we're making progress on these questions that people have thought about literally for thousands of years and been confused about. And that's something worthwhile doing, even if it doesn't help us make a better toaster. I mean, we're not going to make a better toaster because we understand infinity. I don't care about toasters, but I care about infinity. And I think it's a kind of cultural achievement. And it's worthwhile for us as a society, I think, to have some people thinking about these deep questions, many questions, scientific questions, philosophical questions. You know, I think of it as, on a par with having great artists do their work, even though making great art also doesn't help us make better toasters. So there's all kinds of cultural advance in the theater, in art, in math, in science, in philosophy. And those are worthwhile, even if they don't help us with any practical thing whatsoever. It's about valuing the insight, the intellectual insight that we get from thinking about the resolution of these questions that we had. I think it's worthwhile.
I think that's why I felt fine asking the question, because if the answer is yes, that's great. And the answer is no, but as you say, it brings all of these other benefits, then we need both these things in the world. We need the pursuit of knowledge and the benefits from that. And then, you know, inventions and these things are all good. So we've kind of obviously dived in quite a lot into loads of kind of content and ideas around infinity, but just had a few questions about yourself as well, because I do kind of, or the show, try and kind of look at people's kind of story and their motivations and things like this. So just a few things to ask you here, then I feel like I've covered everything really. So just thinking about when you were kind of younger, a child or a teenager, do you remember thinking much about infinity? Tell me about the first time you kind of remember really getting interested in it, just any kind of early interesting experiences around this.
I mean, as a child, I come from a family of engineers. My father was an engineer, and all of my brothers are engineers, and my sister, I have a sister who's a psychiatrist, but all the rest are engineers. And when I went to university, I thought I would also be an engineer. You know, this was sort of my life was planned to be an engineer. But I took this course. It was a drafting course. And my father started as a draftsman, actually. And in that era, of course, you know, before computers, this was many years ago, drafting was close to art, actually, because it was kind of art. You know, you had to draw the machines on paper. And so most draftsmen were also artists. And so my father was an artist as well as a draftsman, but became an engineer then after that. And so at university, I took a drafting class. And it was all about bolts. There's so many different parameters in the bolt. You know, you have a bolt and there's the thread, but also there's the spacing of the thread and the shape of the thread, you know, because it could be pointy or flat and so on, and the angle and on the end of the bolt, you know, maybe if it's a screw, if it has a point and so on, but maybe it's flat. But then on the head, well, there's maybe right before the head, there's the shaft and the length of that smooth part and so on. And then the head, is it flush or is it a hex or does it, you know, what kind of, and okay. So it's all about trying these bolts. And I understand it's totally important, for engineering and for the machine design and so on, to have a deep understanding of this. But meanwhile, then I was also taking some math classes and floating around in the realm of abstraction and realized that actually I wasn't really cut out to be an engineer and I should be a mathematician instead. And so, but it was this funny change because I started as an engineer and then I became a major. In the US, you can change your major quite easily in comparison with the UK. It's much easier to change your mind, you know, midstream. And so I was an applied mathematics major for a while and then I became a pure math major. And then I started focusing on logic specifically and infinity and sort of came at that stage. And then, so it was this kind of whole progression of my life was from something very applied to, you know, slightly less applied to math. But even math wasn't abstract enough because I went to logic and now I'm a philosopher. And so like just this relentless push towards more and more abstraction.
Any idea why you think that is? Why you're interested in the more abstract questions and also maybe specifically infinity? Can you talk to me about some of your, why you think you're the guy so interested in this area?
Well, you know, my sort of attitude towards it is I just work on whatever's interesting. If someone asks a question and I find it interesting, then I'm going to think about it and devote my time to it. And for example, one of the projects that I did, this was shortly after I graduated, I have developed the theory of infinite time computation, infinite time Turing machines. So I have a joint article on that. We wrote the first paper on infinite time Turing machines, and now it's like a whole area of work, and there's dozens of PhDs have been given in this topic and conferences and so on. And it's one of my, I think it is my most highly cited paper, infinite time Turing machines. But before we wrote the paper, I talked with a number of people because I was a very junior person at the time. And I thought, you know, I should just double check because it's a little bit of a weird topic and off the track topic. But I was super interested in it. And I just checked, and some people discouraged me. They said, don't do it. It's not going to get you recognition. It's not the normal thing, you know. And I thought about it, and I just decided to totally ignore that. And I did it anyways, because I found it interesting. And I worked out the theory with my co-author, Andy Lewis, and it led to years of work and many, many papers. And students got interested in it and so on. And so I was totally glad that I took that attitude. And so this has always been my attitude. I just work on whatever you find interesting, and that's the reason to do it. And whether or not it fits in with somebody else's grand project, or maybe there's some pompous researcher who has a program with open questions and so on that thinks you should only work on those topics, and just ignore all such people and do whatever you find personally interesting. And this is the attitude that I found really to work well. I mean, there's another kind of, I guess I was on the other side of this issue a little bit with some of my students, because I've done quite a bit of work in infinite games. So we have many papers on infinite chess now, and infinite drafts, and infinite hex, and infinite Othello, and infinite Go, and infinite Wordle. And okay, there's quite a bit of work now on this topic. And when I was first starting with some of that stuff, and, you know, that work arose in exactly the same manner that I was just telling you. Somebody asked, well, what would it be like to play Infinite Wordle? And so, of course, I'm going to try to figure out, you know, what is there to say about Infinite Wordle? And So some of my students, my PhD students, of course, naturally also got interested in infinite chess and so on when that work was happening. And so they wanted to study that for their dissertation. And I had to, I was a little bit worried, okay, the students, for a student to graduate and get a PhD and the main topic is infinite chess or something, it's maybe not going to help them to get the kind of job that they want. And so I said to my own students the thing that I did, that it should be an extra. It's great to do infinite chess and to be interested in that. I mean, I'm interested in it and I've done quite a bit of work, but, you know, I had the sort of luxury of already having a position and so on. And so I said, you have to also do something else to my students. You can't just do this. This is like the side gig. Just to be on the safe side, because there are these other people who have a different attitude about it. Personally, I think that one can illustrate one's ideas with, you know, in these infinite games. There was a colleague of mine who was a fellow graduate student in Berkeley, Yongwon Kim, in Berkeley, and he was studying Berlekamp's game theory, specifically Go, not infinite games, but finite games. And he helped work out some of the theory of the endgame Go using the Conway game values. And it was really great work. I mean, really fantastic, insightful stuff. And he solved some of the open questions and so on. And so that was really great. He ended up working on Wall Street, actually, which kind of makes sense for someone doing this kind of game theoretic calculations to go into this trading. So it's quite interesting.
Apart from, you know, spending time on Math Overflow, anything interesting you get up to in your kind of personal life outside of work to take a break from thinking about and working on these kind of deep and interesting questions?
Well, I mean, I do quite a lot of things. I like to bake bread, for example, and other things. But actually, most of my life is just about my intellectual activities and writing and so on. And so, I'm sorry, I don't have much to say about that.
I guess, yeah, this work-life distinction is not so much the case, which is a good thing in your case.
It's non-existent in my life. I don't have any distinction between personal life and work life. I mean, it's just talking about interesting ideas with interesting people is my favorite thing to do. When I was at Oxford, actually, it's one of the most enjoyable aspects of being in Oxford was the high table experience, and I was definitely a regular. And what I liked about it so much was that, you know, every night, okay, you get, of course, it's this, you know, fantastic formal meal and very delicious and so on, but the people at the table, you know, it was such a great mix. This is so great about the Oxford High Table experience is that every night, you know, there's going to be some Egyptologist there or a chemist or a philosopher or a physicist or a musician. So that this incredible mix of people and their backgrounds, and they're all like super smart, among the smartest people, you know, in that area. And it was just fantastic. I loved that so much. To have these great conversations with people, you know, a different group of people every night, and they're expert in some totally different realm that I know nothing about, and we would have a fantastic time talking.
Oh, that's wonderful. That sounds great. I don't know if you thought much about this, but do you think the kind of gains we're going to make and advances we're going to make in artificial intelligence and kind of computing over the coming years and decades, have you thought much about how this will maybe aid your work and others' work in understanding infinity?
Oh, I see. That's an interesting question. Yeah. So, I mean, the sort of increasing computer power is going to have some profound effects on mathematical practice. I mean, so far, the current AIs, the current chat programs and so on, I mean, they're extremely impressive, amazing. But I'm not impressed by their mathematical ability yet. It's basically garbage. I mean, if you ask it to prove something, it gives you something that isn't a proof, unless it's like a totally standard proof that it, you know, that it memorized from its training data or something. But if you ask it to prove even something slightly unusual, then in my experience, it's just not reliable. And even worse than that is that, for example, there's this kind of hurdle that happens in mathematical training when a student learns to tell when they have a proof and when they don't have a proof. You know? So before they've met that hurdle, they give you arguments that look like a proof, but they're not a proof. But if they meet that threshold, then they just don't give it to you if it's not a proof, and they can tell. And this is a very important difference, because it's about kind of intellectual honesty. You know, you have to know whether or not you have a good argument. You don't just try it out, because that's not how mathematics works, right? It's not like if you can convince a bunch of people, then it was a good proof. It has to actually be a good proof. It has to be right in order to succeed in proving what it's claiming to prove. Okay, so it's a very important difference to learn, and it's a difficult thing to learn for students. But usually students, you know, around junior level or so third year level can learn this difference between having a proof and not having a proof, and in a reliable way. But in my experience, the chat programs don't have this skill, because they give me something that isn't a proof. They don't care. I mean, in a sense, they're not serious enough to just say, I'm sorry, I don't know how to prove that. And so maybe it has to do with the way they're trained, which is that they're trained to always say something instead of to only say correct things, which is what the skill that I'm advocating is about, right? Okay, so the main point is that the current chat programs aren't good enough yet in making mathematical proofs to be helpful. It's definitely not helpful. But, okay, I don't want to neglect. There are, at the same time, these remarkable developments happening in formal proof. So these are formally verified proofs that are happening in various systems, like Lean is one, and this other one's Calc and so on. These formally verified proof systems where with interaction with a human mathematician, they create formal proofs of theorems that are checked at a level of detail that basically most human published proofs are not. So these formally verified proofs are far more certain in being correct. Sometimes published mathematical proofs have errors in them. It's quite common, actually. There's different attitudes to have about that. You might think, well, okay, sure, there's errors, but almost always they're fixable because the ideas are sound. And this is an attitude that, say, Bill Thurston has defended, and other people. And I've written about this difference of attitudes to take towards errors in published arguments. Maybe it's not so worrisome if you think that the underlying mathematical understanding was sound. And so even if there is an error, it could be fixed in a way. Okay, but these computer verified proofs are just definitely proofs. They're completely certain that the theorem is correct when you have it. And many people think that it will become much more standard to validate in this formal way all mathematical claims. And I think that's going to have profound changes. Sometimes people say, oh, every mathematician will be doing this formal verification of their results. I don't think that's how it's going to work. There's going to be specialists who are verifying the work of other people, because it's its own subject. You know, how to formally verify something is filled with a certain way of thinking about the topic that will require a certain expertise in doing that. But I think it will be far more common that one has
Joel, so just as a final question, something that I'm asking every guest on the show, what do you think it means to live a good life?
What a sweeping question. How can one possibly answer that in a video? To live a good life, you know, I mean, I'm not sure I have anything to say about that. Let's see, what does it mean to live a good life? I'm trying to do the best that I can to be a good person and to value certain things that I think are important. And I'm not sure I have any useful answer to that question. It's too difficult. Yes. Yeah, I mean, one can think back, you know, over the whole life and decisions that are made and so on. And sometimes there's regret and sometimes there isn't. And sometimes you think you did something right. And so I guess it's kind of a... but I guess to live a good life isn't just about whether you have regret at the end or not. I think that's the wrong criteria, right? It's something else more fundamental about the sort of ongoing nature of, are you making the right choices? Are you valuing the right things as the life progresses? And I'm trying to do my best.
Well, Joel, thank you so much for your time today. It's been really fascinating to speak about Infinity and also ask you a bit about your own life as well.
Sure, it's my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you enjoy the Human Podcast, please consider subscribing. I hope to see you soon.